Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad you're spending some time with us over the next few hours. It's a gorgeous night here in the desert. October is absolutely the nicest time of the year to be here in southern Nevada. In the daytime, it's warm and sunny without the blistering heat that can give you a sunburn just by walking to your car. Very nice. If you're thinking about a visit, now's a good time to do it because it won't last. Wanted to mention here at the top of the program about a road trip I just returned from. I had a chance to visit Scandinavia, something I've always wanted to do. It was at the invitation of a group named Exopolitics Denmark, and I'm sending out this note as a thank you for inviting me to speak at their conference 2 weeks ago. Copenhagen, amazing city, and this was an impressive group, too. Included UFO researchers from all over Europe, Britain, Germany, Norway, Sweden, as well as Denmark, and an impressive bunch of people. And it amazes me, it astonishes me, really, that anyone there would have the slightest idea who I am. I mean, I'm a Las Vegas news reporter, but I think it's a testament to the power of Coast to Coast. So many of the people that I met there in Copenhagen stopped me and said that they subscribed to the show. And because most people, it seems like most people in Scandinavian countries speak pretty good English, no translation of the program is needed. Anyway, if you've got a hankering to visit that part of the world, you have my rousing endorsement. We went on from Denmark up into Norway as well, and just beautiful country. Tonight, we explore a few of the mysteries for which Coast is so widely known. In the second half of the program, a paranormal researcher who hasn't been on this show since 2003, so he's way overdue, Dr. Robert Bartholomew, is a medical sociologist with a keen eye for detail, and he's cast a wide net in the world of the paranormal, sort of separating wheat from chaff along the way. Tonight's main focus will be America's version of the Loch Ness Monster. It's known by the nickname Champ, a sea serpent-type creature that's been reported in Lake Champlain for hundreds of years. I was really impressed with the scholarship that went into Dr. Bartholomew's book, and we might have time to get into some of his other interesting works as well. They're just as interesting as the one called Champ that we're going to focus on. But first, before that, coming up in just a minute or so, an American military man, an Air Force missile officer, retired now from active duty, but very active in another pursuit, namely in exposing what he says is a cover-up, an ongoing cover-up of UFO cases involving national security, specifically nuclear missile bases. Robert Salas was stationed at one of those nuke missile bases when an extraordinary series of events occurred involving a UFO and disabled nuclear missiles. He's here on the program years ago to speak about his experiences, but he's now expanded his work to include kind of a broader look at UFO cases involving national security matters. The new book is called Unidentified, and Bob Salas will be here in just a moment to tell us about where his research has taken him. Webmaster Lex and I have collected our usual assortment of oddities and items of interest. We put it all together in a section we call Knapp's News, and it's posted on the Coast to Coast webpage. Included there tonight, a couple of provocative but speculative ideas about UFOs, one about the Roswell crash, a German take on that case that's pretty interesting. Another article that looks at one of the most famous international cases of all time, Voronezh, the day the aliens landed in Russia. It happened 25 years ago this year. I can remember reading the headlines like they were yesterday. So I guess we should say happy anniversary, Voronezh. This case has been so hopelessly polluted by crummy journalism and snarky cynicism that it really has not received the attention it deserves. It was, at least in my opinion, a real case with solid eyewitnesses and some physical evidence as well. For conspiracy buffs, New World Order enthusiasts, we've got an article about one of the founders of the Jasons, And included in our mix tonight, a fun piece about archaeologists who've opened an ancient tomb. They think it belongs to Philip II, better known as the father of Alexander the Great. I love that stuff. Hope you'll enjoy it as well. Naps News on the Coast website. We have a very full plate tonight, so let's get to it. We'll come back in just a moment with Robert Salas to talk about his new book, Unidentified. Stay with us with much more Coast to Coast AM to come. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. Robert Salas served almost 7 years as an active duty in the Air Force until resigning in 1971. From 71 to 73, he worked for Martin Marietta Aerospace and Rockwell International on space shuttle design proposals. From 73 until his retirement in 1995, he worked for the Federal Aviation Administration. He wrote a book called Faded Giant with co-author James Klotz, which details a UFO incident that happened while he was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana. Very dramatic stuff. He was here, the last time he was here was in 2010 to speak with George Norrie about his experiences. But this new book, Unidentified, takes it much further than that and casts a much wider net. Bob Salas, good to have you back on the program.
Thank you, George. Great to be with you. Thank you.
I enjoyed the new book, and I want to start with this. Before we get into sharing with those listeners who have not heard the story about your particular encounter, I was impressed by something that I saw in the preface where you deal with the idea of government secrecy, or more about the idea of the government as an entity, and making the point that it's not one massive organism that moves as one. Talk about that for a minute.
We're talking about the UFO cabal, or
I'm more like about you make a point that and the government isn't just one entity that operates with one mind. It's a lot of different things and has a lot of different priorities. You worked for it for 32 years, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think I've got 35 years of government service total, but. Absolutely. With regard to the Air Force, I criticize the Air Force for not being forthcoming about the UFO phenomenon, but really I'm just talking about a very small part of the Air Force, and then there are intelligence agencies and all of the military agencies that are also involved. There's something like 17 different intelligence agencies operating in the government. And I think one or more of them, maybe most of them have some interest in this phenomenon.
Well, you make the point, separate from the UFO discussion, that there are too many secrets. Too much stuff is classified as secret. They keep too many things private, and it hurts our country and the world in many different ways.
Yes, absolutely. One of the ways, of course, is secret science, which I talk about. I think going back some 10 or so years, the scientists who were studying the global warming issue were given access to data from spy satellites. But the government didn't allow them to use this data in writing papers because it was classified. So that's one way that excessive secrecy keeps real science from coming out. Again, I go into many other ways where excessive secrecy really breeds corruption within government. And there's so many people in government right now that have the ability to issue classified documents and to keep those secrets for practically no reason, almost on a whim.
Well, we'll come back to secrecy as it applies to UFOs and disclosure a little bit later, but let's get into a little of your background. I've been reading about you for a long time. I think we've met before and have seen your testimony and have always been impressed by the story and that you've told and your candidness and honesty, but I never knew that you were at the Air Force Academy.
Yeah. I graduated in 1964.
Was it tough? It must have been tough to get in.
Well, actually, it was. In fact, I was accepted the first time I tried to compete, and then I found out I had a kind of a cyst on my backside and had to be removed because, you know, they didn't like that sort of thing. So I had to compete all over again the next year. So I actually had to win the competition twice, but finally got in. And then once I was in, of course, it's a tough hole to even finish the program.
Yeah.
It's strenuous, but highly rewarding, and I'm very proud of being a graduate of the Air Force Academy.
Was there ever any discussion about UFOs while you're there? I ask the question in this context. There's a famous chapter from an Air Force Academy textbook, a physics textbook, that was made public some years ago by UFO researchers. Once they found it and made it public, it was pulled from the curriculum. But you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that was 1968, a few years after I graduated. But while I was there, there was certainly no discussion about UFOs.
None at all? Not even if there was a story in the newspaper or something?
Nothing at all. Absolutely nothing.
But it is, as you tell in this book, though, some of the people you met at the academy, you think that they might have been involved later. We'll skip ahead a little bit. You ended up at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base later on, right?
Yeah, I was at Wright-Patterson in the summer of 69. And, of course, January of 69, the Air Force decided to shut down Blue Book. Well, after I got to Wright Pat, I ran into one of my classmates. Actually, he was a year ahead of me. Glad to see me, and said they had a job for me. I said, "Well, I was just there to finish my master's degree." He said, "Well, we'll talk later." And then about a week later, I get a call from the base psychiatrist's office, and I hadn't complained about any mental problems or. So that was kind of a strange. But I was ordered to go to the base psychiatrist's office, and I actually refused to go in and see the psychiatrist unless he explained to me why I was there. And finally, they just told me to leave. I think what might have happened, and I'm just guessing, of course, but it's strange. In 69, they still had UFO projects at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. We know that the Air Force investigation of UFO phenomena continued after 1969, even though they told the public that they were shutting down. But I think what might have happened is they might have tried to recruit me if I went in there and talked about my the UFO incident, which happened in 1967.
Yeah, by that point, they would have known about your history.
Right, exactly. And this is actually typical of how they deal with witnesses, these types of events. They actually track witnesses. They find out, you know, what they're up to, where they are, because, of course, the last thing they want is, and by they I'm talking about the people that are keeping these secrets, the last thing they want is for witnesses to get together and compare notes and, you know, nail down the facts, which I think I was finally able to do. After many, many years of investigating.
But you think that they attach something to a file, for example?
Absolutely. I think they, of course, they knew all the principals involved when I had my Maelstrom event. They knew the names of all the principals, my commander, myself, and the guards upstairs, et cetera. And I think with the airmen, a lot of them, they dispersed to different bases. That's another thing they do, is they disperse witnesses so that they won't, again, group together and compare notes. I think they had tracked me.
One of the premises of your book, I mean, you start where Blue Book left off. Project Blue Book is canceled in 1969. The Air Force issues a statement that basically says, look, because we can't find any evidence that UFOs are a threat to national security, we're not going to study this anymore. And then there was another secret memo from a General Bolander that said all national security cases will go to the same place they've always gone. So you use that as sort of a starting point for this book because you know from personal experience that there are cases involving UFOs and national security, and you saw it. You lived through it.
I sure did. I and another crew, there were two incidents at Malmstrom, one in March 16th, 67, mine in March 24th, 1967. And I have the testimony of Walt Fiegel, who was himself a full colonel in the Air Force eventually. At the time, he was a lieutenant, obviously. And I've got him on audio tape. If people want to listen to his statement about UFOs shutting down his missiles, they can go to my website, spiralgalaxy.org, and I've got that on audio tape with his permission, of course. And my commander was Fred Mywald, who also I have on audio tape, confirming the fact that our missiles shut down and that UFOs were seen at the time.
Set the scene. You went to Malmstrom. How long were you there, and what was your job?
I was there for 3 years. I started at Malmstrom in 1966, the summer of 66, and stayed till the summer of 69. I was a missile launch officer. First, I was a deputy on a two-man crew, and then I became a full commander of a crew later on. But when we had the incident March 24th, we were on duty underground, capsule 60 feet underground. We had about six guards upstairs. We were locked in for 24 hours until we were relieved by another crew. So, you know, I couldn't go upstairs and verify this strange object that was reported. And while this object was up there, the missile shut down. They went into a no-go condition. They were disabled. And this was reported by the guards upstairs. We had six guards, and they had all their weapons drawn up there. They were frightened to death.
Yeah, you write in this book that they were sending messages down, which by itself was kind of unusual, I guess, or the nature of the messages, right?
The nature of the messages was they were seeing very strange lights in the sky, flying at high speeds, making unusual turns, and not aircraft, and making no noise. So this was unusual. Typically, they're very professional, and our communications, we did not joke around too much out there. It was all business because they had nuclear weapons to worry about.
So I guess, you know, it's safe to say that it's not just everybody gets this assignment. You're going to be down in there. You're in charge of nuclear weapons. If things go bad and they have to be launched, you're the guys to do it.
Yeah, that's right. And we were prepared to do just that.
So you're cream of the crop guys. You're trusted with the nation's most powerful weapons, not the kind of guys that go off on flights of fancy.
I hope not. No, we weren't. actually, at the time, my commander and I had the ability to launch 10 nuclear missiles if we had decided to do that. You know, with or without a confirming message from above, we could have physically done that. Of course, we wouldn't, but we could have. And so it was a very responsible position. I think now they've got much more safeguards to protect against that sort of thing. But
so the guys up top are telling you, screaming into the radio, hey, there's something weird floating around over the base. At the same time that these lights are over the base and over the missile silo, the missiles are disabled in your silo, and then you were to learn later in more, right?
Exactly. We were after we reported our shutdown to the wing command post, they told us that the same thing had happened about a week earlier at another flight called Echo Flight. And again, all 10 missiles shut down. UFOs were seen there by the security guards and the maintenance people that were had remained there overnight to work on those missiles. And they reported seeing these objects.
How long was it down?
Well, the missiles were, I want to emphasize, they weren't damaged. They were disabled, meaning that the guidance package, the guidance and control system, was no longer viable. What these objects would have had to do was send some kind of a specific signal through 60 feet of earth and concrete and then penetrate our triply shielded cables going to each of the missiles separately and affect a piece of equipment we call the logic coupler, which is part of the guidance package. And all that did was upset the targeting system, so that the missiles could not be launched. Otherwise, they wouldn't have known where to go, basically. So this was a very specific signal they would have had to send to a very specific piece of equipment.
Bob Salas has written about this extraordinary event in Unidentified, the UFO Phenomenon, his new book. We'll pick up the story on the other side here. Santana takes us into the break on Coast to Coast AM. Bruce Springsteen, Burning and Yearning there. I'm on Fire is the song, one of seven top 10 hits from that Born in the USA album. Great album. We're talking with Robert Salas about his new book, Unidentified, the UFO Phenomenon, and this extraordinary series of events from 1967 when he was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana. UFOs appeared over the nuclear missile silos and somehow disabled not one, not two, but 10 different nuclear missile silos by sending some sort of a signal through 60 feet of dirt and concrete and hitting a specific piece of equipment. Coincidence that 10 of them would all go out at the same time? Hardly. We'll pick up the story with Bob Salas right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Salas, I would imagine that even without the presence of UFOs, when a nuclear missile silo, let alone 10, is somehow disabled, it sets off alarm bells and people are freaking out.
Yeah, absolutely. I was there for 3 years, like I mentioned. I never had more than one missile go down for any reason. But absolutely, this losing 10 within a matter of seconds. One of the documents we got back from the Air Force under the Freedom of Information Act was a telex from SAC headquarters to all units saying that this was of grave concern. I use those words, grave concern, to this command. They needed to know what happened, why it happened, and right away. They started investigating this. The Air Force did, and also they requested Boeing, which was the prime contractor on the Minuteman, to formulate an investigation also. So,
how quickly did that start? I mean, are you the very next day, or you and the guy who was down there with you, are you hauled up and questioned, or how long did it take?
Well, as far as the crews were concerned, I'll speak about our crew because I know about them a little bit better, but we were ordered back to our squadron commander his office as soon as we were relieved. In fact, they had a helicopter come out for us. And we walked into that office, and the first thing I asked was this some kind of Air Force exercise? And he turned, he was white as a sheet, said, absolutely not. And then there was a man from AFOSI there who just shoved a piece of paper in our faces and said, sign here. It was a statement that we would never talk about this again to anyone. We both signed that, and after that, we heard nothing about this investigation. We were not asked about it further. We heard nothing more. And we had briefings on a regular basis. Every time we went on alert, they gave us briefings on what was going on in the field. Now, a little bit different experience with the Echo flight, which happened about a week earlier, like I said. They were actually interviewed by people from SAC headquarters came to Malmstrom and interviewed them. So they had a little bit different experience. What I need to say here is that at the same time that our incident occurred, the Air Force was conducting a so-called scientific investigation of the UFO phenomenon. This was the Condon investigation,
right?
Which I'm sure you're well aware of.
Right.
That started in August of 66 and went through the end of 68, I think, when they wrote their final report. That was ongoing during this incident. And part of the reason the Air Force had asked for this is so they could whitewash the UFO UFO subject and not have to respond to the public about it. And they didn't want our incidents to muddy that water. So I'm pretty sure that one of the reasons we were not further involved in any investigation because they wanted to cover it up as much as they could.
Yeah, you would think if the Condon investigation was an honest investigation, this would be Exhibit A. It would be a primary a case for them to look into, and it would be explored. Even if they wanted to just explain it away, it would at least find its way into the report.
Right. And in fact, the chief investigator of the Condon Committee, a man by the name of Dr. Roy Craig, learned about the Malcolm shutdowns from Ray Fowler. Ray Fowler was working for Sylvania Corporation at the time. Sylvania had some of the electrical contracts on the Minuteman, and he had reps in the field that reported to him that this was a UFO event. So Ray Fowler contacted the Condon investigator and said he had information that this was a UFO event. Craig went down there and talked to Fowler. Fowler gave him names and numbers to call and people see. But when Craig showed up at Malmstrom in October of 67, he was told by the deputy base commander, base operations officer, a man by the name of Colonel Chase, that there was no UFO involvement, and Craig basically turned around and went home. They did not pursue the investigation of the missile shutdowns.
Let's talk a bit about causes. What could have caused it? I mean, obviously, you think there's a connection between the UFO sightings and the equipment going down. What was the official explanation? I mean, it hadn't happened before, except when the UFOs were around. Certainly appears that there's a connection between those appearances and the malfunction, but is there some other explanation? Is there some kind of connection between these silos, the 10 different missiles? Because I would think that they'd all have to be built to operate independently.
They were independent systems. These were located about a mile or so away from each other and about a mile or so from the Central Launch Control Center. The Air Force, from the documents we got under the Freedom of Information Act, the Air Force was never able to pinpoint a cause for the shutdowns. They pinpointed the piece of equipment that was affected, and they were actually able to simulate on a bench test how that equipment could have failed, but they could not explain how they did determine there was an external source that affected that piece of equipment, but they could not explain how that source got into the system. Right after I appeared, as a matter of fact, on Coast to Coast in 1996, I spoke with Linda Moulton Howe. She got me started on this. And as a result of that show, I got a call from Robert Kaminsky, who's head of the Boeing investigative team. And he kept in communication with us and told us that they looked at every possible scenario, including power surges, computer malfunctions, even psychological things having to do with the crew, et cetera, et cetera, and they could not come up with a viable cause for the shutdown. I've also heard from other military sources that the Air Force was studying this incident up until 1972, and they still had not come up with a cause as to how the signal was injected into the system.
Well, you just think about it. I mean, they've got to know for a couple of reasons. One is so that they can stop it from happening again. And two is if there's some technology that could do that, they'd like to be able to probably do it to the Russians or the Chinese or our adversaries.
Well, sure. And that technology happens to be extraterrestrial. And if they are able to, have been able to, after all these years, determine how that worked, then, yeah, they might want be interested in applying that, military applications for that.
Bob, how many of your fellow servicemen who were there for this incident have you sort of collected their information? You mentioned about the guy who was in the silo with you. He went on to be a colonel, and his tape testimony is on your website. How many others who were there have you now had contact with who would are willing to verify the story?
Well, a couple of main witnesses, other witnesses are Arnie Arneson, who was cryptographic officer at Malmstrom Air Force Base at the time, and he recalls seeing a telex stating that UFOs were seen during the missile shutdown. Another important witness is Bob Jamison, who was a targeting officer that went out and brought the Oscar flight back up on alert. In other words, they had to go out there and physically retarget the missiles. It's an involved procedure. It took a day or so to get those missiles back up, but he was told actually by his superiors that this was a UFO event. And in fact, there were a famous UFO case called the Belt incident involving a truck driver and a Montana Highway patrolman that saw this craft land near Malmstrom Air Force Base the same day the Oscar flight went down. So, yeah, there are other witnesses. One gentleman who wants to remain anonymous because of his current position, as many witnesses do. But he was in the Echo flight, trying to bring back one of the Echo flight missiles back up on alert, going through his checklist procedures when an object came over UFO, and actually he went down and tried to finish his. After they reported this, he tried to finish the startup procedure for the missile, and each time he went to a particular point in his checklist, the missile would shut down again. Again, this object was overhead while he was doing this, and he concluded that this was an intelligently controlled object that knew exactly how our systems worked. So, yeah, there are others. Witnesses, but again, it's difficult for some of these people to come forward.
Do you have witnesses that have come forward who say, "Now Bob Salas is making it up"? It seems to me that I've seen some correspondence with Robert Hastings, who writes about UFOs and nukes, where people, and I don't know if it's the Malmstrom incident or others, where there are members of the relatives of the servicemen who were there, who say, "No, that's not what happened," who dispute the veracity of this.
You're probably thinking of James Carlson, who's this
Yeah.
Eric Carlson. Eric Carlson was the commander at Echo Flight. James Carlson has claimed that I'm lying, you're not telling the truth about this, et cetera. I have spoken with him. I have sent him my evidence. And actually, if you go to my website, you'll see a couple of pieces of correspondence from Eric Carlson, the commander at Echo Flight, who was there when the missile shut down, and he coordinated the statements made by Walt Fiegel, again the deputy whose audio tape says that yeah, UFOs were there. He corroborated those statements of Fiegel. So, James, I don't know what his problem is, but he has nothing really to back up
Wow.
anything that challenges my facts.
Well, you now know that there's a whole lot of other incidents through your work, through Robert Hastings' work, through some stuff that I've done. There have been incidents at other nuclear missile bases in the U.S., other nuclear missile bases in other parts of the world.
Absolutely. In 2010, Hastings and I organized a conference in Washington, D.C., and we had a man by the name of Pat McDonough, who was actually a missile targeting guy who, in 1966, again, reported UFO overhead at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Bruce Fenstermacher, 1976. Again, UFOs over his missile sites. He was a deputy launch commander, same as I was. Jerry Nelson. This was in 63, Atlas missile system near Walker Air Force Base, which was originally Roswell Air Force Base. Again, UFOs repeated over many nights seen over the missile sites. Colonel Holt of
Bentwaters
Forest fame, yeah. Yes. Again, these were nuclear facilities at Bentwaters Base. And again, in 2013, during the citizens hearing on disclosure, I was able to bring in a couple of new witnesses, Dave Shindelli, Minot Air Force Base, 1956. A very similar incident to mine, although the principals were not named, but he relieved the crew who claimed that UFOs shut down their missiles at Minot in 66. David Scott, another airman, that was Ellsworth Air Force Base. There have been many, many incidents involving UFOs and nuclear weapons.
There's an incident that I shared with Robert Hastings and shared with him, in fact, the original documents that I got from the Ministry of Defense in Russia, an incident in 1982 in the Ukraine where UFOs appeared over this ICBM base of theirs, danced around, performed these incredible maneuvers over a period of 4 hours, these gigantic craft. They would split into pieces and then meld back together and appear and disappear and all this stuff. And then they entered launch control codes. They entered codes that enabled the missiles. They were ready to go. And then poof, the UFOs go away. And at the same time, the equipment goes back to normal. Big investigation is launched by the Ministry of Defense in Moscow. They can't figure out what caused it. They concluded that the UFOs did it, that the UFOs entered these codes as if to send sort of a message. If there's a message being sent, Bob, what is it?
Well, of course, this is speculative, but I do believe the message is simply get rid of your nuclear weapons. These weapons are extremely dangerous to civilization as we know it, obviously. Each nuclear weapon that we had on our missiles was 800 kilotons. To put that in perspective, the weapons that dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were just 15 kilotons. These are enormously destructive weapons of mass destruction. They're not of any use for any kind of a war. It was even Truman made the statement that we could not have a war with nuclear weapons. It would just be completely devastating.
Yeah, be the end of the world. Or they could be saying, look, these may be your most powerful weapons, but they're not all that impressive to us. We can stop them anytime we want. That's a pretty powerful message, too.
Well, I think, but I think basically they want us to do it. I think they would like to see us evolve to a point where, we recognize the fact that we're on the brink of destroying our civilization and that we have to take that action to get rid of them.
Well, you've read about the exchanges between Reagan and Gorbachev in those years when Reagan was president, how they said, wouldn't it be something if we had to unite against a common enemy? And we also have read reports both from Russia and the U.S. In which they said we need to exchange information so that some UFO incident doesn't launch World War III.
Exactly, yeah. And that's why I believe that there is an exchange of information going on worldwide on the UFO phenomenon. However, I think it's being done through intelligence groups within those countries.
Sort of a back channel instead of a front channel.
Yeah, right.
Well, in our next in the next segment, we're going to get into what reasons there could be for a cover-up, who you think might be involved in it, and what would be the benefit of exposing this stuff. But for the moment, I want to ask you this, sort of on a personal note. You say in the preface of the new book, Unidentified, I think you are the dedication. You're dedicating it to your wife for keeping you sort of on the trail. You've thought about giving it up, I guess, at times, doesn't it? It gets frustrating, I would think, and beating your head against this wall, knowing how good the people on the other side are at their jobs. I'll tell you what, Bob, think about that. Stevie Ray Vaughan is telling me we need to take a break. Well, when we come back, I want to get into the personal side of it and then expand the conversation a little bit to reasons for the cover-up and how it's maintained. Stay with us. Bob Salas is my guest here on Coast to Coast AM.